distributing the future broadcast June 5th, 2006 Photoshop Cook-Off.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. Today you'll meet Edie Freeman, the woman behind those funky animals you see on the front cover of O'Reilly books. She's now working as an editor, and we'll talk to Chuck Joyner about a Photoshop contest. Ware 2.0 program co-chair Brady Forrest talks to Josh Peterson about the 43 Places website, and Google's Chris DeBona is back. This time he talks to Chromatic about Google and open source. For the last couple of years, Edie Freeman has been a book editor for O'Reilly. But before that, one of her ideas that, as she put it, had legs was finding the right animal to match with the right technology for the cover of O'Reilly Animal Books. She talks to Mac Voice's Chuck Joyner about the history of putting these creatures on the cover.
You really created a legacy with the O'Reilly Menagerie of Animals.
Yes, I did. It was a lucky guess, actually. About, 8,000 years ago, I happened to live next door to somebody who worked at O'Reilly. At the time, I was actually working for Digital Equipment Corporation. And at night, she used to come over and show me some of the things that they were working on. And they had had some covers designed at one point by a freelance designer, and they weren't quite happy with them. They were just about to take them out to bookstores for the first time. And somehow, I got this idea to try using old engravings of animals, strange-looking animals. And I had some thought that the people who did Unix things for people who were into things like Dungeons and Dragons, and somehow I turned that into bizarre-looking engraved animal. I don't know, it was some kind of a weird mental picture. And I put together some sketches and took them out to O'Reilly's office, which was a strange house out in Newton, Massachusetts, where there were like lots of people crammed into this little house. Half of them had their offices in closets. And I sat with Tim O'Reilly and a number of other people and showed them the sketches, and Tim, they really appealed to him, so he thought they'd give it a shot. And the idea had legs. What can I say? Here it is so many years later. It's been great. I mean, we've really created a very strong brand, and Tim has always been very much behind it.
Edie, over the years, I've heard plenty of O'Reilly authors ask the questions of, what does the animal on the front cover of your book have to do with the content of your book? And the answer usually seems to be, I really don't know. That's what O'Reilly assigned me.
There's always a reason. The first covers that I did, I think one of them was for the VI editor, which is a visual editor. And I went looking for animals, and suddenly there was this tarsier that had the biggest eyes I'd ever seen. And it just kind of magically went together. There were other times when I would lay out the type for the cover and then go looking for an animal that would work with the type. And 9 times out of 10, there would be something about that animal that completely related to the topic. It was just this magical kind of poetic thing that the universe provided. But people always ask why the animal. We actually don't like to tell because it's more fun for people to make their own associations. But we had a whole databases. Sub-series. And I used insects for that to start because they work in communities and kind of work the way that databases work. And we've had some of those software companies were a little upset that we were documenting their software with what they consider to be bugs. I had to do a little explaining about that. But generally, the designers do a lot of research. They look at the topic and they go and they look at the animals. One of the problems we have is that we've used a lot of animals, and human beings don't seem to be able to tell, you know, one insect from another necessarily. So we have to be really careful about trying to find animals that are distinctive enough that people are going to say, oh, that's the camel book, or that's the llama book, or that's the dung beetle book. And they really do get known by that, particularly the pearl camel has become just a huge icon for the whole pearl community.
Did you do you have a background in zoology or anything, or was this just purely one of those ideas that came to you?
Well, no, I have a background actually in graphic design and photography and printmaking, And I just always really loved old engravings, and I happened to have a book of old engravings of animals. And at the time, we didn't have a lot of money to spend on artwork, and these were public domain. And it was just this amazing, kind of everything came together in this magical way, and the rest is history, as they say.
One of the other things you're known for, maybe not quite as well, is being the editor of the O'Reilly Photoshop cookbooks.
Well, the cookbooks are really... they're for people like me who hate to read manuals. I'm the person who sits down, I install the software, and then I mess around with it until I can figure out what it is that I need to do. And Photoshop is so complex, and there are just so many little tricks and tools and techniques that are incredibly useful when you know about them, but you can't possibly keep them all in your head. So when these cookbooks were proposed to us, I just thought, boy, this is a great idea. And it's really amazing. I mean, if you're just a pretty rudimentary Photoshop user and you need to go in and fix the highlight, you know, the glossy highlight on somebody's greasy head from a photograph that you took, you can just go into our retouching cookbook and there's a technique right there, and it tells you exactly what to do.
These are things that most of us can accomplish. You know, in looking at these, you not only can accomplish what you set out to do, but you're also learning as you go.
I had a very heavy hand, in a way, in the editorial, because I wanted to be absolutely sure steps were very clear. We've actually had very few comments from readers pointing out errors. I mean, every time you do a book, there are going to be some errors. Places where things aren't quite as clear as people would like. But I worked very, very hard to make sure that the steps were very straightforward, because it is awful when you're in the middle of something and you're going, and I do control C and what's supposed to happen? And it doesn't happen. And it's kind of like when you're going somewhere where you've never been before and you have specific directions and suddenly there's a detour. The other thing about it is that just looking at them, if you sit down and you just page through one, even if you're not trying to do anything, some of the things just look so cool, you just want to do it. They're like Girl Scout cookies. You kind of can't stop at once.
Chuck asked Edie about this summer's contest, the 2006 Photoshop Cook-Off.
The Cook-Off is this great opportunity for people to experiment with some of the recipes in the books and at the same time have their work looked at by some of the just industry's A-list in terms of Photoshop. Our panel of judges is just an amazing collection of people. And to win some amazing prizes. There are five categories, one for each of the books, and you don't have to purchase the books in order to enter the contest. We have some recipes available for download online. If you find that those are not the recipes that you want to use for your particular thing, then you can go to the bookstore, or you can find a friend, or whatever it is that you want to do in order to find the recipe that's most appropriate for the image that you are working on. But it's really a wonderful chance to win. I mean, the prizes are great. Adobe has really stepped up. And the whole thing is going to roll up to this great event that we're going to have at Photo Plus Expo in New York in November, which is when we will be presenting the awards and the prizes to the winners. And people don't have to be there to win, but it could be very exciting because a lot of the judges are actually going to be there. So it would be a great chance for people to actually get to meet some of their heroes.
So the entries are supposed to follow the recipes in any of the Photoshop cookbooks or the ones that are available online.
The basic idea is to use the recipes. The winning entries are going to be entries where people have taken an original photograph, one of their own photographs, and have chosen a recipe that is appropriate, or a recipe or two, because you can do multiple recipes on one image, and that is appropriate to the image, and they're going to basically be judged on the originality, the composition, the appropriateness, and the use of color, or tonal range if it's a black and white image. And you can do black and white images. It doesn't have to be color. So it's a real opportunity for people to explore and really look at their own images and then use these techniques to enhance or create something from that original. When you enter the contest, you will be sending in, and the whole submission process is online, you will send in the original photograph, unretouched, unmanipulated, along with your final version of it. So the judges are going to be able to see where you started and where you ended up. And I don't know if there are very many photo contests where people do that, where people are asked to do that, but we are asking people to do that because it really is, you know, what's the ingredient that you started with and where did you end up? It's just kind of a wonderful thing to see how the process worked. So I'm very excited, actually. I've not been involved in this kind of a cook-off before. I've certainly been involved in other photography competitions because I'm a photographer myself. But just the idea that we're going to be able to show in the winning entries the original image and the final image, and people are really going to be able to see what is possible. And it's possible without knowing everything there is to know about Photoshop. It's kind of like the instant gratification series, I think, really.
Edie, do I have to have my my subject or my artwork be my own, my photo be my own, or can I go out to one of the online photo stock photo sites and download something and then apply the recipes to that?
Actually, the rules are that your original entry has to be your original work. So you basically need to be the one who shot the photograph, or you need to be the exclusive owner of that photograph. So going to one of the stock houses online, et cetera, and getting a photograph is not really acceptable in terms of the rules. And one of the reasons for that is that we really want to encourage people to get into digital photography also, because it's an amazingly wonderful and kind of a huge, open, endless, creative space that you can get into, and it's so easy to do. So we're really trying to encourage people to get into digital photography and then see what they can do to take their digital photographs even farther with these kinds of techniques. I used to teach photography, photographics, and graphic design, and I always just loved it when the kids came in with stuff and blew me away. It was like nothing I had expected when I gave the assignment. And I have a feeling that's what we're going to see in this contest.
Chuck Joyner, host and producer of Mac Voices, interviews O'Reilly editor Edie Freeman about the Photoshop Cook-Off. You can visit macvoices.com and digitalmedia.oreilly.com for more specific links to the cook-off and to Joyner's full interview with Freeman. Check out our show notes at oreillynet.com/future. It seems as if I barely make it home, get unpacked, and wash my clothes before I'm packing my suitcase again and heading out. This next trip is to the Wear 2.0 conference in San Jose. You can check out the schedule at conferences.oreilly.com/wear, and here's an excerpt from an interview conference co-chair Brady Forrest did with Josh Peterson, CEO of the Robot Co-op. They talked about their 43 Places site. Are there places you'd like to visit that you'd like to learn more about? Places that you've been to and maybe have stories to share with others? Things you'd like to do in these places? Well, that's what the 43 Places site is all about. Josh explains.
When we launched, we had only about 4,000 places that we knew about. And similar to Wikipedia, the site's user-built, where users come and tell us about new places that they care about. It's a little different than a simple wiki setup in that it's got a hierarchical taxonomy, but similar to Wikipedia in that users submit the content and write their own stories about the places, upload photos. We also sit on top of a couple of other services like Flickr and Upcoming to add events and photos to places. So for any place that people care about, we're interested in having a page that people can tell stories about that place and where people who are interested in that place can go and discover the people who want to go there, the people who have been there, and what types of things are going on in that place.
So what are some of your favorite places on the site that have been detailed?
Well, I like a lot of the local sites. I've learned a lot about my own city building the site. So it's one of the things that's fun is we've got about 1,400 people in Seattle using the sites, and there's a lot you can find out, you know, about your own city. We've kind of developed this theme about an interest in trying to live in a place with a new attitude, almost like you're on vacation in your own city. The site's also great for exploring places you could only dream of going. There's one of the other sites we run is called Lists of Bests, and on that we have a list called 1001 Places to See Before You Die. It's based on a book of the same name, and that lists all these 1001 places. It's an absolute dream to fantasize about visiting those places. The pages on India and on Thailand are some of the ones that I'm very interested in, just because places I'd like to go. And there's some great stories and great photos that users have uploaded. We use web services from Google, from Yahoo, Upcoming, and Flickr. And then we provide our own web services as well for all the sites. There's a number of folks who've built applications around our web services for 43 Places. There's also mobile features that we're starting to build out that let users upload a photo or check in from a location to tell users of the site where they are. And then we start to build a list of places where you're a regular based on your frequency of check-in. And then also just letting you right now upload a photo, soon be able to tag a place. Also, you can get the address from a place. So other ways you can interact with the site and also add content to it from a mobile phone.
And you've recently added events as well.
We started seeing lots of users adding events to places. You know, I mentioned the site's hierarchically built, so you'll see something like San Jose inside California. And users started adding events in San Jose as places. The architecture of the site, again, is wide open like a wiki. So we just added a little more structure to those things for events to be able to add an event to a venue at a time and a date and just list info about the event and say who's going. People also list things to do in places. So you'll see things like go horseback riding in Mongolia as one of the things that it actually comes from the list of best list. But the architecture, somebody just lists horseback riding. It's obviously not a place in Mongolia, but it's a thing to do. And so we're looking at ways that we can work in listing those things, which fit quite nicely with our site 43 things, as well as the site list of best into 43 places. So for every city or place on 43 places, we could have a list of the most popular things to do. May someday integrate 43 people in there as well with people you ought to meet in this place. Another whole area, really, that the users have done, again, sort of the yeoman's work that they've done on Wikipedia, is just by correcting and adding and editing all the data on 43 places. So we've turned over the tools for how to run the site over to the users. So at the bottom of every page, users can tell us that a place is a duplicate, that it should be merged under another place, that it should be renamed or that it's misspelled, or that the photos that are being automatically pulled in that have Creative Commons licenses from Flickr are not the right photos. And so it's like a team of 50,000 editors helping to build this big geographic storybook about places.
And so how many of them actually have admin privileges on the site?
Everyone who's using the site has admin privileges to the site for correcting or editing data on the site. We have a tiered level that we use to just give users who've sort of proved themselves at a certain status to be approvers, but everyone has admin approval to edit and correct.
And so right now you guys are working on 43 places. You're focusing on this site.
Yeah, the Robot Co-op, we're a small company, 7 people, and we run 5 sites. It's going to be fun when we get to the point where we have a site for each employee. But for now, we work kind of seasonally on these different sites, and we're excited that we're coming back around to 43 places, and we're doing a big development push on it now. We've released some of these features I've already talked about, the mobile phone check-ins. We've reworked the way tagging works on the site so that you can tag browse multidimensionally, both by topic or by geography. So you can go to a page like the San Francisco page and click on restaurants, and from there you can refine by Mexican. You can add other, tag adjectives that are going to be cheap or expensive. You can refine by neighborhood as well and see where the cheap Mexican restaurants are in all the different neighborhoods of San Francisco. So anyway, tag browsing has been a big push. We've reworked some of the ways that entries work on the site so users can tell different types of stories. So we've added a bunch of categories like news and rumors about a place, or the first time I ever went to this place, or the last time I went to this place. So the site's more about the different types of stories that people tell, and we're building a set of features that are going to use those different entry types in new ways that we think are going to be interesting, particularly on a local level, so that we'll be able to get you news and information about places you care about.
Right now, you guys aren't very map-focused.
There's just better sites on the Internet that have, sites like Google or Yahoo that have resources to license, multi-million dollar map databases. They're always going to be able to do a better job than we can. But we're building up a lot of interesting data about the places people really care about and the stories they have about it, as well as the way that data overlays to an individual. And so there we'll do some interesting mashups, I think, with maps. On the top of every person's profile page, there's a map of the world, and the map colors in by the places they've been and the places they want to go. We can do things like that similarly, some of these other mapping services, again, with the open APIs, to either do it ourselves or let other people plot places they want to go in certain countries over a map, or plot their entries and photos around maps. So we're interested in doing more with that, but at the same time, we don't still see ourselves as a mapping site. You know, one of the things it's interesting to think about is we're building a site that's at once local and global at the same time, and that's just it's a great experience and an experiment to build that atlas of places that locals know about and tourists are interested in that works for both. So, you know, the travel space is full of folks who've really tried to monetize the space and in so doing haven't really created compelling content. And the local space is full of people, you know, trying to get you to review your dry cleaner or talk about your favorite restaurant. And we're kind of blurring the lines of both of those with the local and global architecture of 43 Places. And they're also really committed to building it in a low-monetized, user-created, friendly way that you know, isn't trying to push commerce at the expense of making it something that's interesting. You know, to us, both Craigslist and Wikipedia are great examples of people who provide a service that users fall in love with and really help build and then just kind of get out of the way.
Josh Peterson of 43 Places talking with Ware 2.0 Conference co-chair Brady Forrest. You'll find more information at conferences.o'reilly.com/ware. The last time we caught up with Google's open source program manager Chris DeBona, we talked about this year's Summer of Code. O'Reilly Online editor and open source hacker Chromatic caught up with Chris at the MySQL conference, and after chatting about the Summer of Code, Chromatic asked Chris what else he was working on. DeBona said that, well, probably the most important thing any company should do around open source, first and foremost, is comply with open source licenses.
They're actually not that hard to understand. There's some good books around them, but there's so much value to be derived from using open source software. And the only real cost is understanding the licenses and what they require of you. And so,
and you'd have to do that for other software, proprietary software anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, you have to do it less with open source because there's only one license or two licenses or three licenses to learn, right?
Yes.
Whereas every commercial software has a different license,
exactly,
and a different structure, and
right,
often a different deal if it's a company-to-company kind of thing.
Right.
So at Google, we use a fair amount of software. Now, what's interesting about Google is that we don't actually distribute it in sort of the description for distribution.
Well, the Free Software Foundation might say you're taking advantage of the ASP loophole, for example.
Yeah, well, you know, some people call it an ASP loophole, some others don't.
Right.
I sort of take the perspective that people license things because they like the license and they like what it says, and if the license doesn't have an ASP loophole or it does have an ASP loophole, I sort of think that those developers...
You don't think people choose it for that reason?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that people... Well, no, I do think the developers choose it for that reason. You know, when you Chromatic create a piece of code and release it under the GPL, you're explicitly saying something by doing that.
Right.
You're saying that the requirements of the GPL I'm extremely comfortable with, and that's how I want to share my code. And if you distribute this in a manner which distribution means, you know, shipping on a CD, allowing it to be downloaded, whatever, well, then you need to share your changes, you know, and anything linked to it, because that's how the GPL works.
Certainly.
You know, and so we do that. So the Google Search Appliance, which uses, has a full Linux distribution underneath it, you know, we have a mirror for all that stuff. We have a mirror for all the changes we've done to GPL and even a great number of BSD programs. But yeah, like, but for things just for Google.com, we don't feel an obligation to share unless we want to.
Sure.
Right? Because that's not what the license says. And that
exactly.
said, we've put a lot of work in the last year, and especially coming up over the next year, in releasing more and more code. Like, we released a heap checking, a heap profiler, different memory allocation routines, you know, things that frankly are very useful to developers, maybe not so much for the average end user. But
and these are probably not things that you want to get in the business of selling, for example.
Oh, gosh, no. No, it's not really our cup of tea to do that kind of tools business. But
in fairness, you know, it's probably not like any big company could make a business out of selling those tools either.
Yeah, but, you know, here's the cool thing. Suppose people start using them and they find them useful. Well, they're kind of developing the way we do, and that's kind of cool.
Definitely.
Both from a recruiting standpoint, but also from a, gosh, you know, if more people develop the way that Google does, it becomes harder and harder for standards to get broken. And we're a very big believer in web standards like
Definitely.
HTML and HTTP and sort of these emerging standards around AJAX. So if we can release more and more things that make it more and more possible for people to develop the way that we do. Again, we preserve this sort of, you know, fair level playing surface
exactly.
in the computer industry, which I think is so important. And open source is such a great way to articulate that need. So I have compliance as part of what I do and what my team does. And then we also do code release, and we also manage the patching process. So or at least we're starting to manage the patching process.
Patching in relation to sending patches upstream.
Yeah, exactly. So suppose somebody writes a patch to program X, and they say, hey, we really want to ship this out. We've made it very, very easy for them to do that. Basically, they let us know, and we're going to take credit on code.google.com at some future date. But right now, we just catalog it internally. We ask them to use their Google address and that kind of thing, so the world knows that Google's doing it. There's probably some 200 to 300 packages we're patching right now, and more to come. We're in the middle of trying to set up the corporate agreement with Free Software Foundation, because we have a great number of compiler developers on our staff. So yeah, it's pretty cool, and that's always going to be an ongoing process. So, you know, what else do we do?
I could ask more about that. Are you having much success in getting your patches accepted upstream?
With the exception of the Free Software Foundation, yes. The Free Software Foundation's agreement is something we're working on, and it's just taken a while because of limited resources on our part and the legal staff.
This is their agreement that you sign copyright on your patches over to them, so
yeah,
they can
exactly
enforce their license.
Yeah, so, and we want to do this because...
Absolutely.
So you can go this other route where basically your employees do it individually for every patch, for every project, and it's a huge pain.
And it's a huge accounting nightmare. Your employees probably should talk to your organization as well, just to make sure that...
We invest a lot of time in training our employees on how to do this.
Certainly.
So, but right now, one of the ways they do that is they let us know. Right?
Yeah.
One of the things we're trying to do is make it so that there's very little friction for them to give patches to the Free Software Foundation by getting a company-wide agreement, which is non-project specific. So
right.
If Ian Lance Taylor wants to submit patches to GCC or Make or, you know, any number of the Free Software Foundation's projects, well, then he can just do it. And they'll take it. Whereas before, they'll be like, well, we'll take your GCC patch, but we won't take your Make patch.
You haven't signed the agreement.
That agreement. And, you know, we're kind of nervous about this because now you work for Google. You have a different intellectual property agreement with them probably, and we're going to need some clearance for them.
Sure.
And so we're in this position where we can do an agreement for every patch, or we can try to nail down this company-wide agreement. And that's what we're in the middle of doing right now.
Seems like the way to go.
Yeah, it's going quite well. With any luck, we'll have that done within a month, and we'll be able to really amp up patching. And it's really good, too, because we have a lot of patches to GCC that are just sort of backed up and that we're maintaining internally, which is just stupid. You know?
It's right. It's exactly right.
You know, why should we be maintaining patches for a branch when the mainstream branch wants them? You know,
and other people could benefit from
that. Yeah, exactly. You know,
and it's taking up your time to maintain those.
Yeah, exactly. So their productivity sort of goes down as they maintain more patches.
Exactly.
But as the community together maintains them, it goes up. So, and everyone's goes up. You know, so we all get sort of that benefit from just a little bit of work from everybody versus, you know, we're doing a lot of work and only we benefit from it. And,
exactly.
And we do benefit significantly, otherwise we wouldn't do it. But, you know, gosh, it sure would be better if everyone could benefit, and we could too, in terms of increased productivity of our engineers and that team. So compliance and patching, really, really important stuff. And it's funny because, you know, the external projects are what people notice. You know, people don't notice if you're compliant. They notice if you're not compliant.
Exactly.
You know, and they don't notice if you patch. Really, they notice more if you don't. And so we try to start taking more credit around these things and making sure the world knows that we love them. We've been funding a lot of external organizations. You know, last year we gave away just a bit over $1 million, separate from the Summer of Code, to support different open source software projects, including my favorite was the Portland State University Open Source Lab thing.
Oh, that's a great project. Oh,
it's terrific. You know, they're providing infrastructure for people like kernel.org and Mozilla and Apache and just a zillion smaller projects. And they just got it down. And the best thing about it is they're producing a lot of terrific sysadmins who understand open source infrastructure.
Very much so.
And developers, you
and
know.
Big scale infrastructure as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think it's extremely likely we'll renew that one this year because I'm just really happy with those guys. Yeah, so we're really happy about that. And of course, we do sort of that industry trade stuff where we go to the OSDL meetings and we try to sort of, you know, do our part there. But I'd rather sort of support, you know, code development. You know what I mean?
So, community from the ground up.
Yeah. That's always been my focus. It's like, you know, the more code that Google releases, the better I feel. And I've got this great guy, his name's John Trowbridge, working just on that. And it's pretty terrific. So
excellent.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's doing other things now, too, because, you know, realistically, that's not a full-time job, not for a real developer.
Right.
And, and he is very much a real developer. So, yeah. And that's just the regular stuff. I've actually really been happy with how OpenOffice has been going.
Really?
OpenOffice 2 is actually really attractive.
Well, do you have any OpenOffice.org hackers on staff?
We do. Not very many. We're trying to hire more. So if your listeners want to work in OpenOffice for a living, let me know.
We're hiring people to work on OpenOffice for a living.
Yeah, so I have 4 more open spots for OpenOffice developers. And I want somebody actually willing to work on the Mac port.
Right. You know, just NeoOffice J, but to the actual Mac.
Yeah, port? No, the actual Mac port of it, so it can be all be built from the same thing. So I have a fellow by the name of Kai working on OpenOffice, and his focus has been on the build system because the build time
for
OpenOffice is really painful. So we sort of have this like strategy. It's like, okay, how do we make OpenOffice better? Well, you know, the Sun guys, they know OpenOffice really, really well. They're doing a pretty good job, right? So how can we complement what they do? Well, certainly, we could bring more developers to the table, and so that's what we did with Kai. And then he can make it easier for people outside of the OpenOffice group to work on OpenOffice.
Right, well, make how it easier do you do to contribute. That?
You make the build better. You make the build faster. And this is not an area where the Sun guys are concentrating. They're more concentrating on user functionality. So, you know, so this is a really good compliment. So, because I don't want to, the last thing I want, okay, is for Google to sort of stumble into a party and say, hey, how you doing? We're here. You know, thank
here
God for you.
50
you
people know? We just hired.
Yeah, so that's not our way at all. So we really tried to think about, you know, how can we actually help and not just be some gorilla coming into the room saying, I know what your problem is, because we don't. You know, how do we know what the problems are? We haven't looked at the code base. So Kai is working on the build system first, and then, you know, an area where Sun has identified as being something they're not going to direct resources, but is important to us is the Mac port, making the Mac port better. So we're going to work on that, you know, once we hire people for it. You know, hiring for that job is really, really hard because
I can imagine.
You need somebody who has facility with C++, C, Java, and a bunch of other languages.
Great big all component-based architecture.
Yeah, it's really big. And like the initial load of an OpenOffice program is actually really big because it's not really – and I don't mean this as an insult. It brings a lot of things on at once rather than bringing them on as they're needed. So it has a long load time.
Well, I saw analysis of startup time once that said a lot of its time is spent actually in the linker resolving symbols.
Yeah, so it's like
a great big C++ program.
It's a great big C++ program with Java. And it's like, oh, geez, you know, then you throw in these JVMs and these JITs, and it just gets chaotic.
There's a lot of stuff there.
There is a lot of stuff there. It's funny. I saw an article. I don't know. It may have been the same article where it talked about how hard it is just to get the Zoom box, the drop-down Zoom box implemented. Because right now to Zoom in OpenOffice, you have to go, you know, options, Zoom, and it opens a dialog box, and you select your type of Zoom, you close it, and then it fixes it, right?
It's a far cry from Control Plus.
Yeah, it's a far cry from Control Plus. It's a far cry from click, click, and, you know. And other little things, like I want to be able to add things to the spelling dictionary, right-click add.
Yes.
And it's right-click, click, click, you know. And it's just like all these little issues that once we get past and we're able to bring developers into the fold, we can get past kind of quickly.
Right.
In fact, I heard that the Zoom drop-down box is implemented. It just hasn't been patched to the final release yet. But and that wasn't us. That was somebody else. But, you know, if we can make the source code more accessible, that'll help Sun. You know, that'll help the – there's some developers at Novell.
Makes them work faster.
It'll make everyone more efficient, and that'll be pretty great.
And it probably even increases the amount of people familiar with the code. So you can hire more
people. And it's nice, too, because
they
say, you know what, these Google guys aren't here just to tromp all over us. They're here to help, and that's sort of what we want to say to them.
You're from Google, and you're here to help?
Yeah, I'm from Google, and I'm here to help.
You could use a pony.
You could use a pony. Oh, my gosh, ponies.
Chris DeBona talking with Chromatic about Google and open source. Thanks also to Chuck Joyner and Edie Freeman, and to Josh Peterson and Brady Forrest. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.